I have spent the last 3 days working on several drafts of this sermon. I wrote a lot. Suddenly occurred to me I had to do the dishes. I read a lot more articles. I wrote a lot more. I deleted almost as much, and then realized I couldn't write another word until the house was swept. And then I wrote more, and I read more, and I revised. And I decided at 10:30 last night that it might be best to just come here this morning and say, the Earth's temperature is higher than it has been in 115,000 years, and humans don't have any real practical or meaningful plan to make the changes to cool it down. So whatever your theology, I wanted to say, just set all your objections aside, and let's just pray for the next 20 minutes for a miracle. My other idea was to pull out some unrelated sermon from my sermon file and just ignore that it was Earth Day. I don't like Earth Day sermons. I dread them every single year. While most ministers don't like stewardship sermons, I would give those every week for a month if I didn't have to do an Earth Day sermon. When atmosphere and carbon levels are at the highest levels in 20 million years, and climate change deniers are in power in the wealthiest country in the world, it is difficult to know what to say that might be helpful. In my experience, there are three basic Earth Day sermons. The first is, the Earth is wonderful and we need to take care of it. One writes about how miraculous life or geology or particular places, and then says it's really important to take care of the Earth. The congregation sings Blue Boat Poem and everybody is happy. The second sermon is, let's go home and do something to make our lifestyle more sustainable. Maybe it's changing all our light bulbs or unplugging our appliances every day or riding our bikes or going to the farmer's market or not flying as much. And then again, the congregation sings Blue Boat Poem and everyone is happy. The third sermon isn't very happy. This sermon shares all the bad things that are happening and how sad and terrible it is. It's a fire and brimstone and fear sermon about how just bad things are in very specific details. And at the end, one tells the congregation to write their congressperson or legislature or join a local climate group, and the congregation sings Blue Boat Home. But this time the congregation feels fairly queasy and or guilty. I really wanted to write a sermon worthy of this moment in history, where carbon levels have hit 410 parts per million, or 140 parts per million more than they have been during all of human existence. And most people, well, concerned, just go on with our fossil fuel lifestyles. What would a sermon say that would be worthy of this moment? I started with the first sermon form. Isn't the Earth amazing? Let's take care of it. My idea was to talk about love and about how loving particular places gives us the energy to fight for the whole planet. I wanted to talk about how the Western worldview needs to change to the view of the non-human world as object to use to something really worthy of relationship. My sermon began with my relationship to the land as a child, and it began like this. I was an imaginative child who spent a lot of time outside on our 30 acres. My brothers and I roamed over what must have been 200 acres, all undeveloped. The Earth was alive for me. In Cheney, where I grew up, the Palouse Hills, the ponderosa pine forests, and the basalt scablands all came together. The wind blew in the soil of the Palouse, and the hills with 245 feet of topsoil had the same curving grace as sand dunes. In the spring, they were brushed in new green, becoming the pale yellow of harvestable wheat by fall. And this stole is is made in the image of the Palouse Hills. They were comforting to me and wondrous, and I could feel the holy miracle of creation in them. Later, when I learned the concept, I could see the Mother Goddess lying on her side, her body curving in those curving hills. The basalt scablands were absolutely opposite. Hardened lava flows scoured of topsoil. At the end of the last ice age, an ice dam created Lake Missoula in western Montana, a lake about half the size of Lake Michigan. When the weather warmed, the ice dam broke and water rushed at 80 miles per hour to the sea. It carried topsoil, all the topsoil in its path here to the Willamette and Columbia River valleys. I could hop from one basalt outcropping to another. A thin soil filled some of the crevices in the rock, and in the spring, the most vibrant wildflowers grew there, making a magnificent rock garden. I was sure fairies lived there, and imagined them playing in the caves and the little rocks. The jewel, however, of the eastern Washington landscape was the marsh. The climate was so dry in the inland west, nearly desert, that those few places where water seeped up from the deep and soaked into the ground, staying wet all year, were magical. In the spring, the marshes filled with sparkling water in the sun. When everywhere else was parched yellow, it was vibrant green. Moist greens, dark greens, yellow greens, and emerald greens. Birds filled these small oases. It seemed to me to be exactly what hope looked like. What I wanted to say in that sermon was that when the Industrial Revolution began, the earth became something we used for our benefit, not something alive with its own will and needs. We need to build a relationship with places in order to treat them well and fight for them. But then I thought, the world's temperature has gone up 1.5 degrees Fahrenheit in the last 150 years, and it's going to keep going up. While we absolutely need to re-enchant the world and make friends with it, that sermon was not the right sermon for this moment. So I started writing the second Earth Day sermon. Let's change something in our lives to make it more sustainable. I began with reflection of my own life and living sustainably. It went like this. When I was in the second grade, I moved to an 800-square-foot unfinished house on 30 acres. With another family, my parents were building homes and a farm where we could live lightly on the land. My parents were biologists and went to college right after Rachel Carson wrote Silent Spring. They were immersed in the dangers of our modern life on the landscape and environment of our planet. After Earth Day in 1970, they decided it was their moral obligation to prove that one could live well while making a light footprint on the earth. Our houses were passive soil and built into the earth. We had composting toilets. We made bricks with soil from the property. I spent summer mornings sifting dirt to break up clots and get rid of small sticks and stones so that the soil could be made into bricks. My parents planned to grow all their own food. We had goats, chickens, rabbits, and cows. I spent endless hours in the hot summer picking potato bugs off potato plants and dropping them into small tin containers of gasoline. We lived off the power grid for several years, and I read by the light of kerosene lamps. My parents built a windmill for electricity that worked until a windstorm knocked it over the very next day. I learned the importance of living as lightly on the land with habits that were instilled in me as deeply as saying please and thank you. I have composted as long as I can remember until I moved into a condo here in August. I find the practice of throwing banana peels and coffee grounds in with food wrappers in sick, slick, unspikable advertisements advertisements, absolutely disgusting. I find it so distressing that I plan to grow worms in my very tiny carport soon as possible. My parents and their friends started recycling in Cheney, Washington. I remember using our wagons to haul our newspapers to someone's garage where the papers were stacked high. And now I seem incapable of throwing glass or newsprint into a garbage can. It feels absolutely immoral and wrong to me. All my light bulbs are LED bulbs, and I drive a Prius. I'm figuring out how to use more mass transit in Portland. I eat little red meat and buy organic when I can. In that sermon, I plan to then talk about the importance of instilling sustainable habits that feel as normal as fastening your seatbelt. Then that sermon sort of petered out because you all know all that. I could preach about it, and everyone who does those things would feel really good, and that would be great, and those who don't do all those things would feel guilty, and what really is the point of that? We know the things we ought to do, and we do the best we can. And the temperature would still be rising. My parents' idea was that all of us could live lightly on the land, in small, highly inefficient houses using renewable energy. We could all recycle our waste and grow our own food. They would be the pioneers and others would follow. But I will tell you that the intensity of the work had high emotional, relational, and financial costs. What I learned was sustainable transformation has to be part of community and state and national systems, and not just individual actions that push against the infrastructure that we have. So then I just started on the third Earth Day sermon. Things are really bad out there, and we have to do something right now. And it went like this. World temperatures have risen. That's not right. World temperatures have risen 1.4 degrees Fahrenheit since 1870. 2016 was the hottest year we've ever had, and 2017 already shows patterns consistent with another extremely hot year. Humans and the species have evolved with us have never lived in such a hot climate. Sea levels have risen 2.6 inches since 1993, and scientists predict it will rise about an inch a decade for the foreseeable future. NASA reported this March that in the previous 6 months, the world had lost ice the size of Mexico. The World Meteorologic Organization released their report on the climate in 2016 last month, saying, "We are truly in uncharted territory." Carbon levels in the atmosphere reached 400 parts per million in 2013 and 410 parts per million now. They have been at 280 parts per million for all of human existence except the last 100 years. The present concentration of carbon is the highest it has been in the past 20 million years. And we really don't know, it turns out, what happens next. Both carbon levels and temperature are increasing at exponential levels. If we reduce emissions as much as we are aiming for, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit over pre-industrial levels, the temperature could potentially just keep going up. And there are many reasons for this. When the ice melts, the sea becomes darker and warmer, and so the ice begins to melt faster. Once the tundra thaws, it releases more carbon and methane. There are models that show possibilities of what might happen, but no one knows for sure. Or even whether we can, at this point, keep world temperatures from rising more than the 3.6 degrees above pre-industrial levels. So, for example, in 2015, when greenhouse levels were supposed to start decreasing due to the reduction of carbon worldwide, atmospheric methane levels increased. And no one knows exactly why. Methane is produced in cow stomachs, fermenting rice fields, fracking, coal mines, and forest fires. Something caused methane to increase. Meanwhile, fossil fuel companies are extremely powerful with money and lobbying, influencing members of Congress and other decision makers at all levels of government. Scratch the climate denier movement, and you will find wealthy, neoconservative, liberal extremists who are committed to their vision of unfettered capitalism. They understand, more than many others, I think, that to effectively respond to climate change means the end of their ideology. They created a very purposeful and powerful campaign to reduce coverage of climate in the media and began to spread climate change doubt as a way to keep ideological dominance. Wide agreement exists that 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit would be more than a 3.6 degree Fahrenheit increase, would be extremely dangerous for life on this planet. It's already gone up 1.5 degrees. Scientists believe that we can add only 565 more gigatons of carbon into the air and still come out below 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit of world temperature increase. However, worldwide fossil fuel reserves equal 2,795 gigatons, or five times what we can burn to today below 3.6 degrees. And those companies, every day, are searching for more oil and more coal and more gas. They have no intention of stopping. And most do not take climate change regulations very particularly seriously. After researching and writing these facts, I couldn't breathe. I was looking over the edge of a cliff. A cliff I had stood on before, but an incredibly unpleasant cliff. And I had to look away. My daughter and I made waffles and omelets. We cleaned the kitchen. We read Flora and Ulysses by Kate DiCamillo, which is marvelous and made us laugh a lot. It was all so normal. It felt like this is what I've been doing all these years. This is what I want to do. The world is burning, and I want to go for a walk. I want to think about the places I've loved. I want to muse intellectually about the Western view of nature and how to change that view. I want to clean my counters with environment-friendly cleaners. I want to go to the farmer's market and buy fresh spinach and lettuce and sugar snap peas. I want to buy a worm composter to eat my food scraps. I don't want to stand on this precipice. Spring was too early or too late in so many places this year. Natural cycles didn't sync, beginning even more quick destructions of ecosystems. I don't want us to stand on this precipice. People will be wandering, helpless, seeking places to put their tent and find some food and to live. Already, refugees are not welcomed. Already, they are villainized. This will grow a worse as floods of people grow larger and stronger, running from storms and drought and the rising sea. I woke early this morning, and I watched the sun rise through my bedroom window. I remembered that the sun rises and sets each day, and has since Earth's creation. Rebecca Solnit, in her book, Hope in the Dark, says that hope comes in our awareness that we cannot know the future, and that the future often surprises us. Joanna Macy says, because we can never know for sure how the future will turn out, it makes more sense to focus on what we'd like to have happen, and then to do our bit to make that more likely. That is what active hope is all about. I remembered then what Kathleen Dean Moore, the philosopher and climate change activist, realized at the end of her book, great tide rising. Well, sitting next to an Alaskan stream, she considered the force of political power and how we, ordinary people, can successfully rise against it. She watched the river as it eddied and moved around rocks and branches. Throw a rock in the stream, and the rock and the river must flow around it, she says. Throw a stick in and watch it catch on the bank, slightly altering the stream's path. Put enough in that stream and it will slow down, change its course, and flow with less strength. You don't have to have a comprehensive plan to change the river. You can simply persistently interrupt the flow of the stream. Over time, the stream will change. It's not in the media very much, but rocks and sticks are hitting the stream of fossil fuel dominance all the time. People across the world are standing up for places that they love and saying no to the extraction that threatens their healthy water, soil, and air. Naomi Klein, in her 2015 book on climate change, This Changes Everything, talks about the rise in blockadia, as she calls it. Blockadia is a disconnected movement, with some connections, of civil disobedience against the extractive industries. There are movements that stop the coal ports in Oregon and Washington, and the pipelines from the tar sands in Canada. They have held off extraction projects all over the world. Indigenous people are claiming their rights for clean water and air as part of their treaty rights, and sometimes they win. The Community Legal Education Defense Fund works to help communities write and pass community bills of rights. These are laws that allow communities to assert local democratic control over corporations and stop extractive and other polluting industries from setting up in their towns. They have passed these community bill of rights in over 200 towns and cities. Just this January, the Community Legal Education Defense Fund filed a lawsuit on the behalf of 6 Spokane residents. The case claims that federal laws that preempt city health and safety laws over fossil fuel rail shipments violates residents' constitutional rights to a healthy climate and local self-governance. One of the plaintiffs, actually, is a longtime member of the UU Church of Spokane, and 2 of the other plaintiffs are longtime Spokane activists, and I used to work for them when I was in my 20s. This case follows a case that was settled in November in 2016, where there was a federal court decision here in Oregon that recognized that people possess a fundamental constitutional right to a livable climate. Meanwhile, citizens are demanding local and state governments do more to stop climate change. In Oregon, the legislature is considering House Bill 3125, a bill that puts price on pollution from carbon and other greenhouse gases emitted from burning fossil fuels. It repeals former goals and establishes new goals for emissions in 2025, 2035, and 2050, and creates investments in clean energy and jobs in rural communities. Citizens are working here in Portland to stop PEG from building 2 more gas-powered electric plants, and are continuing efforts to try to stop the Longview Millennial Coal Export Terminal that is on the southwestern Washington coast. 2019, April 29th is Climate Mobilization Day, and there are mobilization efforts across the United States, including in Portland. Meanwhile, Fossil Free and 350.org are planning a worldwide fossil fuel divestment effort from May 3rd to May 13th this year. The purpose is to begin a moral movement against the fossil fuel industry practices and profits, as well as allowing all of us to say, I'm personally not going to financially benefit from this industry. It's Earth Day. 47 years ago, the first Earth Day inspired my parents and so many people to turn and begin to care for the planet, this planet that is our only hope for life. Every year we get to make this choice to turn or not to turn toward the Earth. So, I want you to love the places you love on this amazing planet with all your heart and all your mind and all your soul. Walk in those places. Remember those places. Wonder what it means to be in right relationship with those places and see what that means. Change all your light bulbs. Drive less. Walk more. Go to the farmer's market. Buy less stuff. Fly less. And begin to feel the habits of sustainability take hold in your life. And most importantly, join with other people and start discovering rocks and sticks in the stream and start throwing the rocks and sticks in the stream of fossil fuel power. Fight the coal ports and the coal trains. Stop PGE from starting two more gas powered plants. Divest from fossil fuel. Insist that lawmakers place meaningful greenhouse gas reduction plans. Sue. Stand in the way of the machines and people that destroy. Fight for the places you love. Fight for this earth. We cannot know the future as much as we think we can. But we can turn ourselves toward the future that we want, and we can begin to walk towards it together. So let us turn together. Let us turn this world around. Let us prepare for a future where all life flourishes. Let us turn this world around.
Thanks again, Tracy.